And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April the 7th, 97th day of the year. 268 days until the year ends. Before I get started, I want to make everybody aware of a little gizmo I found. If you ever wanted to have the internet in your pocket and not carry around a very expensive hotspot, it's called a UAMA by Roku. And it is probably one of the most sophisticated little devices. It fits in the palm of your hand, and it's a portable Wi-Fi. And I have been using it off and on this morning. And it just absolutely says no service. Service is back. But if you are someplace and there is no Wi-Fi available, just take it out of your pocket and go online. Now, it doesn't give you all the sophistication of being hooked into somebody like Spectrum or Verizon, but it's really good when you don't have anybody else available. On this day in history, in the year 451, Attila the Hun sacks the town of Metz and attacks other cities in Gaul. 529, the first draft of the Corpus Juris Civilis, a fundamental work in jurisprudence, is issued by Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian I. In 611, the Maya king Yuna Chan of Calakmul sacks a rival city-state Palenque in southern Mexico. 1141, Empress Matilda becomes the first female ruler of England, adopting the title Lady of the English. 1348, Charles University is founded in Prague. 1521, Ferdinand Magellan arrives at Cebu. 1541, Francis Xavier leaves Lisbon on a mission to the Portuguese East Indies. 1724, premiere performance of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion, BWV 245 at St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig. 1767, end of the Burmese-Siamese War, which ran from 1765 until 1767. 1776, Captain John Barry and the USS Lexington capture the Edward. 1788, American pioneers to the Northwest Territory establish Marietta, Ohio, as the first permanent American settlement in the Northwest Territory. 1789, Selim III becomes Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and Caliph of Islam. 1798, the Mississippi Territory is organized from disputed territory claimed by both the U.S. and Spain. It's expanded in 1804 and then once again in 1812. 1805, Lewis and Clark Expedition. The Core Discovery breaks camp among the Mandan tribe and resumes its journey west along the Missouri River. 1805, German composer Ludwig von Beethoven premiered his Third Symphony at the Theater in Wien in Vienna. 1827, John Walker, an English chemist, sells the first friction match. He invented it in 1826. 1829, Joseph Smith, founder of the Latter-day Saint movement, commences translation of the Book of Mormon with Oliver Cowdery as his scribe. 1831, Emperor Pedro I of Brazil resigns. He goes to his native Portugal to become King Pedro IV. 1862, American Civil War. The Union's Army of the Tennessee and the Army of the Ohio defeat the Confederate Army of Mississippi near Shiloh, Tennessee. 1868, Thomas D'Arcy McGee, one of the Canadian Fathers of Confederation, is assassinated by a Fenian activist. 1890, completion of the first Lake Biwa Canal. 1906, Mount Vesuvius erupts and devastates Naples. 1906, the Algeciras Conference gives France and Spain control over Morocco. 1822, the U.S. Secretary of the Interior leases Federal Petroleum Reserves to private oil companies on excessively generous terms. You know the fix was in on that one. 1827, the first long-distance public television broadcast from Washington, D.C. to New York City, displaying the image of Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover in it, took a wide screen. 1933, prohibition in the U.S. is repealed for beer of no more than 3.2% alcohol by weight, 8 months before the ratification of the 21st Amendment. It's now called National Beer Day. Okay, in 1940, Booker T. Washington becomes the first African-American to be depicted on a United States postage stamp. 1943, the Holocaust in Ukraine. In Terebovlia, Germans order 1,100 Jews to undress and march through the city to the nearby village of Plibanivka, where they're shot and buried in ditches. And their only crime was being Jewish. I just find that entire concept to be so ridiculous. 1943, Ioannis Raulis becomes collaborationist prime minister of Greece during the Axis occupation. 1945, World War II, the battleship Yamato, one of the two largest ever built, is sunk by American aircraft during Operation Tango. 1945, World War II. Basoko is liberated by the 7th, 9th, and 17th Krahinga Brigades from the 10th Division of Yugoslav Partisan Forces. 1948, World Health Organization is established by the United Nations. 1948, of course, it was always has been politically motivated in what it does. Witness the current disagreement over what created or who created COVID. 1949, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific opened on Broadway. It would run for 1,925 performances and win 10 Tony Awards. 1954, United States President Dwight D. Eisenhower gives his domino theory speech during a news conference. 1955, Winston Churchill resigns as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and amid indications his health is failing. 1964, IBM announces the System 360. 1964, bulldozer kills Reverend Bruce Clunder, a civil rights activist, during a school segregation protest in Cleveland, Ohio. The results were a bloody, expensive, unnecessary riot. The individual driving the bulldozer should have been arrested and prosecuted, but that didn't mean burn down the town. 1965, representatives of the National Congress of American Indians testified before members of the U.S. Senate against the termination of the Colville tribe in Washington, D.C. Motor racing world champion Jim Clark is killed in an accident during a Formula 2 race at Hockenheim. 1969, Internet symbolic birth date, publication of RFC1. And I didn't even get an invite to the Internet's birthday party. 1971, President Richard Nixon announces his decision to quicken the pace of Vietnamization. 1972, Communist forces overran the South Vietnamese town of Lac Ninh. 1976, members of Parliament and suspected spy John Stonehouse resigns from the Labour Party in the UK after being arrested for faking his own death. 1977, German federal prosecutor Sigmund Rubach and his driver shot by two Red Army faction members while waiting at a red light. 1978, development of a neutron bomb is canceled by President Jimmy I Am Just Absolutely Wonderful Carter. 1980, during the Iran hostage crisis, the U.S. severs relations with Iran. 1983, during STS-6, astronauts Story Musgrave and Don Peterson perform their first space shuttle spacewalk. 1989, Soviet submarine Komsomolets sinks in the Barents Sea off the coast of Norway. 42 crew members die. 1990, Iran-Contra. John Poindexter is found guilty of 5 charges for his part in the scandal. Now on appeal, his conviction is later reversed. 1990, a fire breaks out on the passenger ferry Scandinavian Star. 159 people die. 1994, Rwandan genocide. Massacres of Tutsis begin in Kigali and Rwanda. 1994, Auburn Calloway attempts to destroy Federal Express Flight 705 in order to allow his family to benefit from his life insurance policy. Didn't quite work out as he intended. 1995, First Chechen War. Russian paramilitary troops begin a massacre of civilians in Shamaski in Chechnya. 1999, the World Trade Organization rules in favor of the U.S. in its wrongdoing trade dispute with the European Union over bananas. 2001, Mars Odyssey is launched. 2003, U.S. troops capture Baghdad. Saddam Hussein's regime falls 2 days later. 2009, former Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori is sentenced to 25 years in prison for ordering killings and kidnappings by security forces. 2009, mass protests began across Moldova under the belief that results from the parliamentary election are fraudulent. 2011, Israeli Defense Forces use our Iron Dome missile system to successfully intercept a BM-21 Grad launch from Gaza, making the first short-range missile intercept ever. 2017, a man deliberately drove a hijacked truck into a cloud of people in Stockholm, Sweden, killed 5 and injured 15 others. Of course, he had a political agenda, but really didn't accomplish a lot. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Abert of Crespin. Blessed Alexander Rollins. Blessed Edward Oldcorn. And Blessed Ralph Ashley. Blessed Notker the Stammerer. Brynock. Aegisippus. Henry Walpole. Herman Joseph. Jean Baptiste de La Salle. Patriarch Tikhon of Moscow. That's in the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Episcopal Church in the U.S. It's on Slovenia, it's Flag Day, Genocide Memorial Day in Rwanda, International Day of Reflection on 1994 Rwanda Genocide in the United Nations, Motherhood and Beauty Day in Armenia, National Beard Day in the United States, Sheikh Abid Amani Karum Day in Tanzania, Women's Day in Mozambique, and internationally, World Health Day. Okay, let's see what else we have, if anything. Okay. Scholar on the year 30 A.D., scholars' estimate for Jesus' crucifixion by Roman troops in Jerusalem. Eleven 18, Pope Gelasius II excommunicated by Henry V, the Holy Roman Emperor. Uh, 1348, Prague University. First university in Central Europe. Charles IV formed it. 1456, Louis von Bourbon becomes Prince Bishop of Luc. 1498, crowd storms Savonarola's convent, San Marco, Florence, Italy. 1509, France declares war on Venice. 1521, the Inquisitor General Adrian Boyens bans Lutheran books. You know what's interesting? To stop an idea, folks who believe in their own importance want to ban books. 1584, Leper surrenders to Duke Van Parma. 1625, Albrecht von Wallenstein is appointed the German Supreme Commander. 1645, Michael Cardoza becomes the first Jewish lawyer in Brazil, and the world didn't end. 1655, Fabio Siggi replaces Pope Innocent X as Alexander VII. 1712, a slave revolt in New York kills 6 white men and 21 African Americans are executed. To base charges and punishment on the color of somebody's skin is absolutely makes as much sense as Cher saying that if I'd have been in there when George Floyd was killed, I could have saved him. She has since apologized for that statement. She needs to understand her day has run and she needs to hush. Okay, 1739, Dick Turpin executed in England for stealing horses. 1794, English chemist and theologian Joseph Priestley departs England for America on board Samson at Gravesend. He was a chemist, a theologian, and an author. 1795, in a move that has confused generations ever since, France adopted the meter as the basic measure of length. It was created by mathematician and astronomer Jean-Baptiste Joseph Delambre. 1796. Okay, everybody seems to think my time is theirs because they hear my voice so often on the air. Well, I talked about the fact that the Lewis and Clark expedition left Fort Madden and started their journey to the Pacific Ocean on this day in 1805. Explorer and leader was William Clark. The interpreter and the guide was Sacagawea. And, of course, co-leader with William Clark was Meriwether Lewis. 1818, General Andrew Jackson conquered St. Marks, Florida from the Seminole Indians. 1831, Dom Pedro abdicates to his son, Dom Pedro II, who became Emperor of Brazil. Interestingly enough, the Emperor of Brazil invited defeated Southern officers to come down and give them land. And there was, until not too long ago, a town in Brazil where every morning they raised the Confederate flag. 1860, Grand Duke Frederick I liberalizes the law in Bath. 1863, the Battle of Charleston, South Carolina. The Federal fleet attacked Fort Sumter and failed to capture it. 1891, Nebraska introduced the 8-hour workday. 1895, polar explorer Fridtjof Nansen reaches record 86 degrees 13.6 minutes north latitude, and that's the closest any expedition had come to the North Pole until that time. 1901, the SDAP demands general voting right, abolishing the first chamber. 1902, Texaco, which is the Texas Oil Company, is formed. 1919, the first parcel of land is purchased for Cleveland Metro Parks. 1921, revolutionary leader Sun Yat-sen is elected president of China at Canton. Even in spite of this, China remained divided into North and South and subject to rivalries of warlords, but he is considered the father of modern China. 1922, Warren Harding's Interior Secretary, Albert B. Fall from El Paso, leased the Teapot Dome Oil Reserve to Harry Sinclair of Sinclair Oil. That set in dome everything needed for the Teapot Dome scandal, which became a major political embarrassment to the president. 1923, the Workers' Party of America became the official American Communist Party. Also in 23, the first brain tumor operation under local anesthetic was performed at the Beth Israel Hospital in New York City, performed by Dr. K. Winfield Ney. And in 26, on this date, Mussolini is shot at 3 times by Violet Gibson in Rome. She hit him once in the nose. Yeah, let's see. In 1933, the first 2 Nazi anti-Jewish laws went into effect. Jews were barred from legal and public service. On this day in 1939, Italy invaded Albania. In 1943, Lieutenant Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg seriously wounded in an Allied air raid. And in 1945, Kuniaki Koiso resigns as Prime Minister of Japan after the U.S. invasion of Okinawa. He's replaced by Kentaro Suzuki. And also in 45, the Battle of Okinawa, massive kamikaze attack of approximately 110 Japanese aircraft damages 3 U.S. battleships off Okinawa Island. And the Sonderkommando Elbe, a special Luftwaffe unit, was created and used to destroy Allied planes by ramming them in midair. They were sent on their first and only mission of the war on this date. All righty. On that note, we are going to move on to our topic of strangeness for today. You know, there have been so many odd happenings. It's hard to keep them all, shall we say, sorted. One of the most famous bizarre occurrences in history is the story of the Bell Witch. Which took place in Tennessee. Now, it's often classified as a poltergeist occurrence, despite the fact that the entity identified itself as a witch. And this is a haunting that's achieved what you might say is near legendary status. Supposed to have occurred in the early 1800s, the Bell Witch story revolves around a curse said to have afflicted a man named John Bell and his family. Now, the curse was pronounced by his neighbor, Kate Batts. She claimed till her dying breath, John Bell had cheated her in a sale of some land, and she was determined she was going to have her revenge. Now, you can find a full write-up in American History Magazine, 1800. And according to what it says, from 1818 to 1835, the stories of the Bell Witch created great excitement in Robertson County and throughout Middle Tennessee. Of course, like most legends, the Bell Witch has very little in the way of documentation beyond the anecdotal reports of the locals, which should not be discounted, let me say. Almost everything that survives related to the case involves second and third-hand reports, but they do make interesting reading. Now, there was an entry in the Tennessee, in a book called Tennessee, A Guide to the State, It's part of the American Guide series. It was compiled by the Federal Writers Project and published by Viking Press in 1939. Now, the Federal Writers Project was a kind of a make-work project that took place during the Depression and continued for some years after that. Now, the story was published long after both Kate Batts and John Bell were dust. And although this might was hard to be considered primary material, the entry is still one of the oldest surviving articles that has come to light. Now, according to the story, the Bell Witch Farm has long been called that because it's widely believed that a witch hag rode John Bell and his family during the early part of the 19th century. Now, at the turn of the century, John Bell came to Tennessee from North Carolina and bought a tract of land and settled with his large family and numerous retainers. I mean, he was a man of some property. And to round out his holdings, he bought a section of land from Mrs. Kate Batts. A neighbor had a reputation for just being mean as a snake. Now, Bell was noted for an almost grim piety and uprightness, but no sooner had the land transfer been complete, Ms. Batts began declaring that Bell had cheated her. And this fancied injustice just totally upset that woman for years, right up to her deathbed. And on her deathbed, she swore she'd come back and haunt John Bell and all his kin, kith and kin to their graves. Well, according to tradition, the Bells were actually tormented for years by the malicious spirit of old Kate Batts. And John Bell and his favorite daughter, Betsy, were the principal targets. Now, for some reason, the entity seemed to have a special fondness for Bell's wife. The other members of the family, it was kind of indifferent. Nobody ever saw her, but every visitor to the Bell home heard Kate Batts. A voice, according to one person who heard it, spoke at a nerve-wracking pitch when displeased, and other times it sang and spoke in low musical tones. In the spirit of old Kate Batts led John and Betsy Bell a merry chase. She threw furniture and dishes at them, pulled their hair, pulled their noses, poked needles into them. She yelled all night to keep them from sleeping and snatched food out of their mouths at mealtime. Now, though they were the primary targets, the witch didn't confine her capers to the Bell farmstead. She attended every revival in Robertson County and outsang, outshouted, outmoaned the most fervent converts. And the unseen Kate was actually, according to all reports, very fond of corn whiskey. She would constantly raid still houses, get roaring drunk, and come home to belabor John and Betsy with renewed fervor. Now, how do you think a spirit imbibed alcohol? Well, when Betsy fell in love with Josiah Gardner, a young man who lived on the adjoining farm, old Kate included Josiah in her displeasure. In fact, it got to the point Gardner gave up, fled the state. Now, when old Kate's fame reached Nashville, which was the capital of Tennessee, Andrew Jackson and some friends decided they were going to face the terror and lay at it once and for all. So in high spirits, they set out for the Bell Farm. When they got to the boundary of the Bell's property, the wagon in which Jackson and his friends were riding would not move. No matter what the mules did, they couldn't get that wagon to move, and Jackson cursed. Finally, out of the air came the voice of old Kate Batts, who said, "Okay, General, the wagon can move now," and it did. And that night, Kate kept the house in an uproar. She sang, she swore, she threw dishes, overturned furniture, pulled the bedclothes off the beds. And according to the story, the next morning, Jackson made an early start, swearing it to Bell as he left that I'd rather fight the British again than have any more dealings with that torment. Well, when John Bell died, the Bell witch is said to have disappeared. The original farmhouse had been torn down. In intervals, the newspapers revived the story with an account of how some descendant of Bells is due for a visitation, which they say is the lot of one person each generation. Now, the interesting thing about the death of John Bell, he was taking medicine, and supposedly someone switched his medicine for poison, and that's how he died. Now, most of the information that's been repeated seems to have been taken from a publication by one of the Bell descendants, Charles Bailey Bell. He's a neurologist that lived in Nashville. He wrote a book called The Bell Witch, A Mysterious Spirit, printed by the Lark Bindery in 1934. She had said she'd be back in 35. And prior to this work, there was a publication referenced in an authenticated history of the famous Bell Witch. Was written by Martin Ingram, published in Clarksville by W.P. Titus in 1894. Unfortunately, no copies of that earlier work seems to have survived. Now, for those curious about this famous American haunting, you can find information in what's called the Studies in Philology, Volume 16, dated 1919. And this report, based on Ingram's lost book, there are indications of which had an interesting power to appear in the form of animals. It manifested as something like a dog to Mr. Bell, and on another occasion, his son Drew saw the witch take the form of something similar to a turkey. One of the Bell servants, a man named Dean, claimed to have seen the spirit in the guise of a large black dog. Betsy and the children saw it as a little girl dressed in green, and on another occasion took the form of a hare. Well, notably, only a few other poltergeist cases include reports of strange animals appearing in association with the spirits. Primarily among those is a visitation reported on the Isle of Man in the 1930s in which the spirit identified as a poltergeist was reputed to appear as a small talking animal, kind of like a mongoose. A strange, mischievous little being declared its name to be Geff, and tales of Geff the talking mongoose are familiar on the Isle of Man to this day. Well, from the Bell Witch, let's go talk about the Corpse Dancer. Now, in the popular folklore of Europe, demons and spirits of the damned were associated with places of execution. And sometimes they were associated with the physical remains of the murderers and the thieves themselves. Now, normally, this association resulted in rumors that witches and necromancers had made use of the bodies of executed criminals as components for their spells. At least one spell in the Liber de Angelis calls for the magician to go to a place of execution in order to call up the dark spirits of a curse. But nowhere is the connection between demons and the gallows quite so pronounced as is the story of Nicole Aubrey. Now, Nicole was a young woman from Vervins in France. And by all accounts, she was, in the parlance, quite the looker. In an account recorded by the 18th century folklorist and theologian Dom Augustin Calmette, this poor woman came to the attention of a demon by the name of Baltazo. Now, it seems Baltazo had amorous intentions toward Nicole, but she was a married woman, and according to the story, she spurned his advances. I don't know of many females who would want to have a dalliance with a demon. Though I do know a few young women who, if they had the dalliance, the demon would turn and run. As part of his infernal courtship, the demon purportedly took possession of the body of a hanged man who then stepped down from his gibbet and accosted Nicole's husband. The demon demanded the right to pass a night with the poor woman while clothed as the executed man. And in return for one night in her conjugal bed, the demon promised to leave Nicole alone for the rest of her life. The husband, not really trusting the demon and not wanting to share his wife with a dead man, which is understandable, I guess, declined this dubious offer. The report is silent on what happened after that. Have you ever talked to people who swear they can have precognitive dreams? Well, there is stories that purport to show that these things happen. Now, precognition is the psychic ability to gain glimpses of the future, often in the form of what we might refer to as prophetic dreams. And most instances of precognition are difficult to verify, mainly because the dream is a one-time event and the experiencer fails to write the details down until after the foreseen events transpired, and then you're dealing with a case of Monday morning quarterbacking. More rarely still are precognitive dreams taken seriously by authorities, which typically leads to silence among those who have endured these nightly visions. They never expect to be taken seriously, so they keep their experiences to themselves. Well, this wasn't the case with a young man named David Booth, 23-year-old living in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 1979, Booth was working as an office manager, but his nights were plagued with a recurring dream. Every time he would close his eyes and start to drop off, he ended up watching a deadly plane crash at an airport. First, he heard the sounds of engines failing, and then he saw the plane swerve and roll in the sky, and finally it plunged, inverted to the tarmac, and the end result was a wreck of metal and flames. He could even see the company logo on the plane, American Airlines. Now, he was certain this was no mere night terror and that this crash would actually happen. So on Tuesday, May 22nd, 1979, he called American Airlines. If there was a way he could prevent this tragedy, he felt obligated to try it, even if he ended up sounding crazy. But just on the off chance he was crazy, one of his calls was to a psychiatrist. Well, he called American Airlines, as I said, and he called the Federal Aviation Administration Center at the Greater Cincinnati International Airport. And he earnestly told him the story, and he hoped he'd be taken seriously. Now, in most cases of precognitive dreams, when or if the dreamer reaches out with their warning, nobody believes them. This is called the Cassandra effect, named for the ill-fated princess of Troy in Greek myth who foresaw the fall of that great city, but whose warnings are universally ignored. In Booth's case, though, he had so many compelling details in a dream that the FAA actually paid attention. It was later explained by Jack Barker, the public affairs officer representing the FAA's southern region. They scoured their available information, trying to match what Booth was seeing to potential flights. The plane he described strongly suggested the crash would involve a DC-10. So they knew who the airline was. Even had some details about the airport and its runways where the crash was going to occur. The problem was they couldn't put the pieces together in time. On May 25th, at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, American Airlines Flight 191, bound for Los Angeles, lost an engine just after takeoff. The plane faltered, rolled in the air, and crashed, inverted, onto the runway in a fire explosion that killed all 277 people on board. At the time, it was the deadliest air disaster the U.S. had ever experienced. But interestingly enough, each detail of the crash matched David Booth's dream, down to the make of the aircraft. It was a DC-10. So how many of us have precognitive dreams and don't do anything about them? I'm sure more than you would suspect. Well, from precognitive dreams, let's talk about American vampires. Now, if you keep up with American vampire lore, you've almost certainly heard about the case of Mercy Brown. Mercy, who lived in Exeter, Rhode Island, was one of several family members to succumb to tuberculosis. Now, in those days, that affliction was known as consumption. Mercy's mother, Mary Eliza, had been the first to die, and she was followed in 1886 by her oldest daughter, Mary Olive. Mercy and her brother, Edwin, both contracted the disease. Mercy died January 17, 1892. But at this point in time, rumors were running rampant that somebody in the family was a vampire, and they were afflicting the other Browns from beyond the grave. Now, at that point in our history, that was a common superstition, tied up with poorly understood mechanics of contagion and corruption. Well, by March 17, 1892, the fears of the remaining family members had grown so extreme, they consented to have Mary Eliza, Mary Olive, and Mercy all exhumed and examined for signs that they might be vampires. Now, the main sign everybody's looking for involved a lack of decay in the corpse. As a belief in vampires went at that point in time, the life force being stolen from many family members went to support the corpse in the grave. And this, of course, would ensure that the corpse did not decompose. Well, when the three deceased members of the Brown family were exhumed, both Mary Eliza and Mary Olive were found to have what onlookers deemed natural signs of decay. However, Mercy looked like she just laid down to sleep. Well, according to the experts of the day, her heart and liver were removed and burned. The ashes then used as a tonic and given to Edwin to drink. It's believed that by drinking this concoction, he'd stave off the vampire and be cured. Well, he died 2 months later. As strange an episode as the Mercy Brown case might seem, it was by no means an isolated incident at the time. Moncure Daniel Conway, writing in Demonology and Devil Lore in 1879, talked about one Dr. Dyer of Chicago, Illinois, who reported on an 1875 case of vampirism in that city. Details almost identical to the Mercy... Mercy Brown case. Family members were dying of consumption. One of the earliest to have died was accused of being a vampire. And the family, of course, all believed that member, unchecked, would bring all the rest of them to the grave. So, in a move that you might consider self-defense, they dug the corpse up and mutilated it. In this case, only the lungs were burned and used in the cure. Based on Conway's information, Mercy Brown was only one in a long line of Rhode Island vampires exhumed to keep other family members alive. 1874, a family with the last name of Rose had a similar outbreak. They lived in a Peacedale, Rhode Island, and like Mercy, was her daughter who fell under suspicion of being a vampire. The Providence Journal reported that tale, which ended once more with exhumation, mutilation, and a desperate stomach-churning attempt at a cure. The report doesn't say if this particular cure was any more effective than any of the others. Well, it's a short step from American vampires to discussing Halloween hags. In the U.S., we dress up for Halloween. Children run around begging for candy, threatening tricks if they don't get their treats. Now, this Halloween, or All Hallows Eve, to give it its proper name, actually came to the U.S. with the Irish immigrants. You know, the celebration takes place one night before the Catholic Feast of All Souls. Fully secularized and commercialized since then, Halloween's evolved into a uniquely American holiday. But the Irish were not the only people in the British Isles to practice All Hallows tradition before Halloween came to America. In Wales, specifically in the vicinity of Llanfihlin, there used to be an old custom for the working men to dress themselves in sheepskin and ragged old clothes on All Hallows Night. This practice is discussed in some detail in an 1891 publication called Bygones, relating to Wales and the border countries. The men would mask their faces and take to the streets, going from house to house, stopping at the public houses where they drank for free during the celebration. The whole night was one of rowdy carousing and begging, and people would give coppers, apples, and nuts. Sounds to me like you needed more coppers to try to keep the nuts under control. These All Hallows revelers were called quachad, or hags. The tradition actually stemmed from a belief among the Celts that the fiends, witches, and fairies had thought to all be abroad on their baleful errands during this night. Since the revelers were working men and not children, the celebration could get out of hand, leading to tussles and destruction of property and Eventually, the practice was put down by the police. Kind of reminds me of the practice called the Stag Night, where the men from one village will go accost the women in another village. That kept her from being too much inbreeding. We've had some fascinating customs in the past. Well, let's talk about what might be considered the work of the devil. In the Middle Ages, the devil seemed to be everywhere in Europe. And if one credits the witch craze, Satan himself spent a great deal of time touring the countryside and seducing helpless old women into flying off with him to have wild orgies in the woods. Through a liberal application of torture, witch finders would pull colorful, elaborate, and wholly incredible confessions from suspected witches. And many of these detailed the varied and devious ways in which the devil and his many demons sought to corrupt and obtain human souls. Now, according to folklore, demons weren't always a nuisance to humanity. Occasionally, the devil or one of his cohorts could be put to productive use. Geralt de Givry, in his lavishly illustrated collection Witchcraft, Magic, and Alchemy, recounts a number of tales that attribute feats of great industry to demonic beings. A variety of bridges and other building projects supposedly constructed with the help of the devil. Well, and what was his traditional payment for his assistance? He would request the soul of the first living being to make use of his work. So if he built a bridge, the first one to cross it, the soul was his. Well, while he villagers would apparently take the devil's help and find a way to trick him out of what he was entitled to. And this gave rise to the tale of the wolf's door at the cathedral in Aachen, Germany, where a wolf was supposedly driven into the new cathedral when it was finished, so that this wild beast would fall prey to the devil in place of some righteous soul. There's a similar folk belief recorded in the stained glass at the old church in St. Cato in France. Here the devil finished construction of a local bridge and requested the soul of the first living being to walk across it. St. Cato came on the day of the bridge was finished and released a cat, which resulted in the devil being cheated. One of the most interesting versions of this story of the devil's connected to the devil's work is connected with nothing less than the Grand Cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris. According to the story, during the construction of the Great Cathedral, a journeyman worker was given a task of producing the ironwork for the doors to Notre Dame. The work was to be his test piece for admission to his guild, but he found the work was just too much for him. Each door was an immense 22 feet by 13 feet, and he was expected to decorate this entire expanse. Well, to his assistance came the demon Biscornet, or Biscornet. He offered to produce cunningly beautiful ironwork over all the doors in exchange for the journeyman's soul. When desperate to complete his task, the journeyman agreed. Next morning, four doors for the right and left doorways were completed, and the ironwork was amazing to behold. Wasn't even a visible seam. But Biscornet could not complete the work on the middle doors because these would see the passage of the Holy Sacrament during processions. And since Biscornet couldn't finish the task, the journeyman got to keep his soul as well as the four completed doors. And these were up on the cathedral for all to see until Vallée-le-Duc's restoration of the cathedral in 1860. Now, the current doors are actually a faithful reproduction of Biscornet's work, but they lack the inhuman perfection of the previous pieces of ironwork. Well, from France, let's go to Medina County, Ohio. And if you live near Medina County, you've heard about the Witch's Ball. It's not a dance or a Halloween party. Medina County's Witch's Ball is actually a grave. Now, the ball is located in an out-of-the-way cemetery called Myrtle Hill, which is close to Crybaby Bridge on the Abbeville Road, which is another allegedly haunted location surrounded by local legends. Cemetery is off the beaten path, and although a number of houses have started to encroach on it in recent years, it's still fairly remote. surrounded by open fields and woods. Now, a lot of locals frequent the Witch's Ball, especially in and around Halloween. According to the story, a witch is buried under the striking spherical monument emblazoned with the name Stoskopf. Now, the witch, for one reason or another, and depending on which version of the legend you've heard, the reasons tend to vary, still lingers near her earthy remains. And she's not happy to be there. Allegedly, this huge granite spear perched on top of her monument thrones with powerful energy. It's cold in the summer and warm in the winter. You put your hands on the witch's ball and feel the temperature of the stone suddenly change. That's considered a bad omen. One of the more elaborate local legends grown up around this unusual monument is that the witch was one of three sisters, all buried in the area in graves marked with some manner of spears. And these three graves are arranged along ley lines, and they describe a triangle that marks a place of dark energy. Now, people have sought the other two graves, but so far there have not been any success. The ley line myth is likely just that, and little research reveals that despite the reputation of the Stoskopf grave, it's a man and not a woman that's buried there. Despite all this, the legends still continue about that grave. Paranormal researcher Nick Ryder of the Avalon Foundation looked into the myth of the Witch's Ball in the late 1990s. And though no angry witch leapt out of the shadows to attack or curse him, he did learn that the huge granite spear that has what amounts to an electromagnetic pulse. Close inspection of the monument shows that the granite has a high quartz content, and Nick's theory is at least some of the strange sensations experienced by those laying hands on their gravestone are legitimate. Rather than rising from the failing powers of a dead witch, he believes that it's a natural geode that exists within the stone. This collection of quartz crystals, combined with the size and shape of the stone, seems to conduct a small but perceptible amount of energy, which is recordable on instruments. So that raises the question, how many other alleged witch effects are caused by purely natural or scientific effects we don't understand? Well, taking that one step further, would it seem strange that at least at one point in the history of paranormal research, it seemed more plausible to some investigators to explain ghostly apparitions based on the action of human telepathy rather than allow for the possibility of the spirit's survival after death? From the Journal for the Society for Psychical Research in November 1889, written by Samuel Joyce Jr., this writing professes to explain so-called phantasms of the dead, which was the name he used for apparitions of spirits, which he wanted to explain through the mechanism of telepathy or thought transference. And amazingly enough, he was not dismissed as a crackpot by the Society of Psychical Research. So some merit must have been seen to his argument, or it wouldn't have been in print. Now, according to the letter, in investigating the subject of apparitions, the Society for Psychical Research have named one class phantasms of the living, being cases of the appearance to friends or relations of people at or near the moment of death. Now, these have been very successfully dealt with on the telepathic theory, and this writer believed that cases of phantasms of the... you can extend that theory to cases of phantasms of the dead. And he said it had already been done to a certain extent. In her paper on Phantasms of the Dead, in Part 8 of the Proceedings of the Society for Psychical Research, Mrs. Sedgwick gives four theories for apparitions. First two require the agency, though practically unlimited time, either the mind of the disembodied spirit or the quasi-physical spirit itself, but much as we may believe in the mental activity of a person when dying, we have no right to assume continued activity after they die. The third and fourth theories should be combined, as she believes together they will give a working hypothesis for the examination of new cases. These two theories are that the first appearance is not due to the dead at all, but a purely subjective hallucination on the part of the individual who sees it. And subsequent appearances are on the part of the first participant due to unconscious expectancy. You expect to see it, so you do. Well, if in fact that is the case, does it take more mental gymnastics to explain away ghosts as telepathic projections? Well, I would not think that is the case. Well, let's talk about the Theosophical Society formed in New York in 1875. It's dedicated to the exploration of mediumship and the many applications and powers. Now, at that time, the phenomenon of mediumship had become more than a passing fancy in both America and England, thanks in no small part to the strange occurrences at the Hydesville, New York, home of the Fox Sisters in 1848. The Theosophical Society promoted the study of what they called theosophy, which essentially means knowledge of God. Now, it was headed by the charismatic and controversial figure of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and they started off with fairly simple goals. After a few years, though, the headquarters of the society was moved from New York to Madras, India, a locale which at the time seemed exceptionally exotic to the most Westerners. Now, the move to Madras reflected one of Blavatsky's great passions. Passion which was to have a hefty impact on the beliefs and goals of society. In a time when imperialism was grinding the country of India underfoot, Blavatsky was looking at Hindu culture with envy. Where British colonials saw a country of backward heathens who worshipped at the altars of strange gods, Blavatsky saw a culture that was hundreds of years older than anything could be boasted about in the West. And she saw a culture that possessed a rare and profound knowledge of the metaphysical practices she and her society thought to understand. Well, her sympathy for India helped give the Theosophical Society new direction. Their goals included the establishment of an idealized universal brotherhood that could be blind to color, race, or creed. Now, the organization was indelibly stamped with her passions and beliefs, and when she died in 1891, the society, well, let's say it stumbled a little bit. Significant figures that rose to the top included Anne Besant and Rudolf Steiner. Steiner eventually moved on to found the Anthroposophy. And Besant could easily be credited with shaping the beliefs of the New Age. The question becomes, how much of what she and her organization said have turned out to be true? Are the ascended masters she spoke about, do they really exist? I've talked to many people in the 30-some-odd years I've done this show who believe that they exist, and I've talked to others who say it's all horse caca. What's the truth? Well, we've run out of time for tonight. We'll be back tomorrow when we'll talk about psychic witnesses to murder. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.